Ryan Stanton here with ASAP Frontline, joined today with one of my originals from ASAP, one of the first people I met as I got involved with the PR committee through ASAP, Dr. Al Sacchetti, who's the Chief of Emergency Service at Our Lady of Lourdes Medical Center in Camden, New Jersey, also Assistant Clinical Professor of Emergency Medicine at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, apparently right across the river from each other. Us folks in the Kentucky area didn't realize that close association there. And Al is probably one of the go-to persons for the American College of Emergency Physicians when it comes to pediatric-related issues. Very active with pediatric emergency medicine, and a talk here on pediatric fever, of course, something that gives a lot of physicians angst when the kids come in here. The vast majority are going to be just fine. Their brains aren't going to melt, much to the public mindset and thoughts of what happens when a child gets a fever of 104. But then again, you have those that we're trying to catch, that very small segment of the population that we're trying to catch that may have something significant going on. So, Dr. Sacchetti, thank you so much for joining me, and tell me kind of the mindset and basis behind the talk that you're doing, and then how it's going to advance the practice for us community, quote, pit docs out there that are going to see these kids through the winter.
I got to tell you, Ryan, it's interesting. I work in a community ED. We see a lot of kids, but it is still community ED. And we are completely, unscripted in terms that we have no dedicated pediatric ED. We have certain cribs and stretchers, obviously, that we don't put the bariatric patients in, but we use them for the kids. But no, all our docs and all our advanced practice providers see all the patients, all the kids. So we're in the same mindset as you have, which is, you know, we are all, the entire department is seeing the kids. We don't have a dedicated group that just sees the pediatrics. And for us, every kid that comes in with a fever, you know, when you pick up the chart, they have meningitis until proven otherwise. You know, so when you walk in the room, you've got to make the decision. And the talk today is going to be on what components of the physical exam, what components of the history, what components of the diagnostic studies are relevant to a kid with a fever in 2017. The interesting thing is when you look at the literature now, if you've got a fully vaccinated kid in a community that vaccinates their children, the odds of them having something bad is ridiculously small nowadays. It doesn't mean that they don't have the kid with the meningococcemia, you don't have the kid with some overwhelming septic issue from E. coli, but the majority of those kids, like you said, are just going to be viral syndromes. You're going to be able to look at them, you're going to be able to reassure the parents. As Howie Mel once said, he said, I'm in the business of reassurance. And so you can reassure those parents, make the kid look a little bit better, cool them down, and they'll do just fine. When we looked at the latest stuff, there's nothing based on the history that's changed from years gone by. You know, the difference that we found is the longer the duration of the fever, the more likely they are to have something significant going on, a serious bacterial infection. Most of the time, it's going to be a urinary tract infection. Whereas in the pre-vaccination era, you know, the day one, the kids got something like H influenza or a strep pneumonia, septicemia. Those kids died by the end of the day. Now, with the vaccinated kids, they go for days with these smoldering infections, urinary tract infection or something like a cellulitis. So the duration of the fever doesn't really help. The height of the fever doesn't tell you anything anymore. In the past, the higher the fever, the more likely they were to have strep. Nowadays, the height of the fever doesn't matter. Either you have a fever or you don't. And in fact, the higher the fever is, what we're seeing is a lot of these kids with 104, 105, well, they have roseola or one of the virus syndromes. So we're not seeing that being correlated with anything really bad. And in fact, as I guess a lot of your listeners are going to tell you, yeah, the last kid I saw with meningitis had a temp of 101, you know, type of thing. So nothing there. Big thing now is all these diagnostic tests out there. You've got the procalcitonin, the C-reactive protein, the CBC, all these tests out there. And what all the data is showing is, yeah, they have a little bit higher sensitivity, but it's not much better than your clinical judgment. To be honest with you, Ryan, if I had you walk into the room and look at a kid and tell me sick or not sick versus that battery of lab tests, you're going to be right more times than the battery of lab tests are going to be right.
That's what I love to teach to students is kids. One thing I love about dealing with kids is when you walk in, kids don't lie. They act just like they feel. If they feel fine, they can have a temperature of 104 and bouncing around the room, you know, just like they've been on crazy sauce all day. But, you know, adults, they've learned how to play the part. They respond basically how you feel. They feel like they're supposed to respond. So, you know, when you touch their belly and they go, oh, that's painful, but then you use your stethoscope and you push down and there's no symptoms whatsoever. You know, they respond how they think they're supposed to respond. But pediatrics, they play the part they feel. And so when I teach students, I say, when you walk in the room for a pediatric patient, stop at the door, take just a few seconds to look, because 95% of the time you're going to know whether that kid's going to end up admitted to the hospital or not, just based on what you're seeing when you walk into that room. And pediatrics, more than anything else, has had a quantum shift during the generations of physicians that were currently in practice with the advent and widespread usage of vaccinations, especially the Hib vaccine that has basically changed the presentation and approach to those 3 months. I mean, for the first 3 months, whereas used to, first 3 months were an automatic full court press, where now we have 1 month, yes, second month, probably in the third month, maybe, depending on the situation. So we're having a huge change, a huge shift, and we have multiple generations of physicians that are in right now that have been through every single phase of that operation. What are some of the things I need to look for when I walk into that room as we get into the season where we're going to see a bunch of viral syndromes, colds, flus, bronchiolitis, things like that? What are some of the things I need to look for when I walk into that room that are going to either trigger the we're okay or the trigger, oh, we need to take a closer look at this and really dig down deep?
You bring a couple of really, really good points up, Brian. One of the things that we did is we moved our cribs directly across from the nurse's station. And part of the reason to do that was that it would allow a doc, when they went to the computer to pick up the next patient, to just stand there and look at the child. And when you do that, you're absolutely right. Before you've approached them or anything else, you've made your decision, sick or not sick. Either the kid's rattling the crib trying to get out of there, or the kid's just laying there, you know, kind of oblivious to what's going on around them. A couple of things that the literature says, which I thought was interesting. If a mom says, I'm concerned about my child, there's something different about them, that correlates very highly with the child having a serious bacterial infection. So the first thing is, listen to the mom. If the physician's gut feeling is, this kid's sick, huge correlation with something really bad going on. So what you said is exactly true. Your gestalt feeling when you look at that child makes a big difference entirely. In terms of what to look for specifically, when you look at all the other things, are they crying, how high is the fever, those types of things, they're all over the dartboard. But the one thing that seems to correlate very well is if they're tachypneic. If they have retractions, particularly if they have retractions and they don't have any respiratory component to it, the retractions are because they're breathing fast. And if they're breathing fast, that means their metabolic rate's up. There's something driving that tachypnea. And you need to look a little bit harder on those kids. Sometimes it's just the fever alone, but it's worth looking a little bit harder on them to make sure you're not missing something there on them.
Have we had significant change last I've heard? You know, we're still 20, that 28-day mark is your absolute mark, and then your second month is the probably, and we mentioned the third month is maybe, and then as long as they're vaccinated after 3 months, you just send them out to the wolves. In most cases, don't do that. Just do a real evaluation. Don't listen to me. Are we changing much? Is the research saying that we are doing the adequate evaluations, doing what we need to do, or we still have the opportunity to adjust that time frame of evaluation a little bit?
You're spot on. Under 28 days, full septic workup. It's still there. There's a lot of people trying to push the envelope. We don't have to do an LP on those kids. I think you still do. There's still enough meningitis in that age group that I think it's risky not to do it. When you get that 28-day to 6 weeks, and then that's shrinking down. It used to be 3 months, like you said. Then it went to 8 weeks. Now it's about 6 weeks. When you see those kids, most of them are saying, do the full septic workup. You do the CBC, the blood culture. And I still do the spinal tap, and a lot of people still do. There's a growing number of people who aren't doing the spinal taps. They're saying, well, the kid looks pretty good. I'm a little shaky under 6 weeks of age that I can say the kid looks pretty good. But there's a little bit of push for that. But most people are doing the full septic workup, some criteria. If the kid looks good, meets all the criteria, they can go home. And then over 6 weeks or 8 weeks, wherever you want to set your cutoff, pure clinical judgment. You don't have to draw any tests unless you really feel you need to. They're pushing that a little bit. There are people saying, well, you know, if everything else is normal, you don't have to do the LP. My own gut feeling is it's probably easier to do the LP in that kid than it is to get the IV in them. You know, and everybody sleeps better when you do the tap. I will say that there are centers now that are pushing it. There's no published criteria out yet. But some individual centers are saying, yeah, you know, our infectious disease people say we don't have to do it. I was talking to one of the emergency physicians, who's a pediatric emergency physician, one of the big university centers. He said the residents are now graduating never having done a spinal tap. Their peds residents are graduating never having done a spinal tap on a kid because of this, because they're saying, no, we can look at these other tests to make a decision. I'm a little bit old-fashioned like you. I'll still do the full septic workup under 6 weeks of age.
I think another big question out there, and actually we ran into this just within the last couple of weeks, is kids that come in don't look terribly sick, but they're inside that window. You get the workup, and they look good, so you don't necessarily feel like they have to be in the hospital. And that idea, the question behind giving a dose of, say, imrosefin or, you know, antibiotics, and then that 24-hour follow-up. Now, I'm not a huge fan of giving an antibiotic presumptively in those cases where I have a concern for potentially something sick. And I'm not talking about strep or ears or whatever it may be, but you know, where we actually do the septic workup and get blood cultures. So making sure that you have a blood culture before you do that antibiotic, because even talking to the pediatricians, you know, once you give the antibiotic, it just really fuzzies that picture if they come in sicker later. What are your thoughts on the whole idea of a dose of antibiotics and then the next day follow-up?
There's actually some good studies on that. When you and I grew up, this was in the 80s, and you had the occult bacteremia with the strep. That we did that all the time. You drew the blood cultures. If the white count was over 15,000, you gave them a dose of antibiotics. You brought them back the next day, gave them another dose till the cultures came back. What the current thought is the following. Under 4 weeks of age, under the 28 days, all bets are off, full septic workup, keep them in the hospital. After 28 days of age, if you do the full septic workup and they meet all the low-risk criteria, their white blood cell count's correct, there's no urine infection, those types of things, and you did the LP and it's negative, there's data out there now that says that child can go home without the antibiotics and with close follow-up. There's other people who say, yeah, I understand that data, but I still want to give that one dose of the 24-hour antibiotic, the rosefin, whatever I want to give them. And then bring them back and check them in 24 hours. It's still an option out there. Picture's a little bit muddied there, but you would be on very solid ground if you decide to give them the antibiotics. You'd be on really, really good solid ground if you decided not to give them the antibiotics if they're in that low-risk group.
Unfortunately, I think the antibiotics for us are basically, talking pediatrics, our version of a pacifier. Makes us feel better sending that kid home with some type of, maybe it's going to protect them, maybe it is not. So we've got these patients, we've got all of this going on. I mean, my concern a lot of times is the fact that we've gotten so aggressive at drawing cultures now across medicine that we're now dealing with all of these false positives and dealing with those things, callbacks and things like that. But of course, on the pediatric population, there is some increased risk of the contamination just because of the goat roping that is blood draws in kids. But that's a very applicable population for making sure that happens. Now we're getting into the season that we're going to have our croups and our bronchiolitis and things like that. Is there anything that has changed? So this population, they'll come in, they may look a little bit crummy. So we're not talking about the newborns at this point. We're talking about the pediatrics, the typical pediatric age range for these. And they may come out and look like they're working pretty hard. That croup patient, if you work nights like I do at 1 in the morning and the kid comes in with some stridor, you know, give him a little bit of racemic epinephrine and the Decadron, and you know, they're looking actually pretty good for a while and things like that. And the one reason I ask about this, my sister's child was just admitted earlier this week overnight with croup after coming in typical 2 a.m. type stuff. How do we address those patients that look a little crummy when they come in, but they perk up pretty well once they get in there to the emergency room?
I think you're right. I work, you know, the night shifts as well. The data is pretty clear. It's pure clinical judgment. You hit them with the Decadron, you nebulize the Decadron, you can hit them with the nebulized epinephrine, watch them for a couple hours. If they look good, yeah, you know what? I'm going to let you go home. You have a little bit of a cough. It's 100%. I've seen enough croups that I think this one's going to do okay. There's no good data. There's croup scoring systems, which I don't think anybody uses anymore. It doesn't help you. I mean, you can make the scoring system look as good or as bad as you want. You know, if the kid's sitting quietly on mom's lap, their scoring system is going to be great. If you get the kid riled up, as soon as they start to cry, they're going to start barking like a seal again. They're going to have a horrible croup score. So it's pure clinical judgment. I've got nothing to add to exactly what you said, which is, you know, I look at the kid, I make my call. They're going to go home. Some of them are going to bounce back. It's just the nature of upper respiratory infections. Bronchiolitics are a different story. Those, there is good data now that says the high flow nasal cannulas, the high humidity nasal cannulas work wonders with those kids. And the sickest ones we see, they work absolutely great. So, you know, that is something I think we, as emergency physicians, you really need to get into your department.
So you have, and as we're sitting here right now talking with Al Sacchetti, there is an interestingly a bat doc about to poke up over the window. Oh my gosh! So if you haven't, we talked to Ken Milne, and you're gonna see that coming up here.
No, please do not let Ken Milne in here. This...
as he about wrecks the wrecks the podcast booth.
Yep.
So my most favorite Canadian decided to drop by the booth just now, and if you didn't catch his suit from, I posted it yesterday. It was kind of a mess at that. So you mentioned the so let's review it again because with that. So we talked about some of the things that changed practice, and you mentioned that high flow humidified oxygen. So just review that again with our bronchiolytic kids.
Yeah, I mean it's the there's a couple commercial outfits out there. I'm not wedded to any of them, but the one we happen to use is the Vapotherm unit. We keep a unit in our department. We use it in adults and kids, both. But for the bronchiolytics, boy, it's taking that kid that you were just about ready to intubate. You put them on this, it washes out their carbon dioxide. It jumps their oxygen way up. It moisturizes everything. They cough like crazy for about 15 minutes, mobilize all those secretions, and then they do 1,000% better.
So finally, we have something that shows to be a little bit beneficial in bronchiolitis because we're already seeing the likely that human metapneumovirus version will transition over here soon to the RSV and then right back to human metapneumovirus again. So we're already seeing it. Actually saw a few cases before I left to come here to ACEP 17. So Dr. Sacchetti, Al Sacchetti, who's from up in Camden, New Jersey, as well as practicing in Philadelphia, Our Lady of Lourdes and Thomas Jefferson University. Thank you so much for joining us and talking to us about the pediatrics and helping us all feel a little bit more comfortable as we get into the infection season. Any closing thoughts or advice for our physicians out there as we head into our infection time of year?
No, I think you covered it all. I just have to thank you because these podcasts are awesome. I will say, I listen to these religiously, and the information I get out of them is tremendous. So thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate it, and the whole goal is to help folks like me who are the community docs out there on the front lines of emergency medicine caring for our patients at their time of need, and as for me and for you, apparently that's a PR thing to do is work nights, and it's to make sure that at 2 and 3 in the morning we're comfortable with the patients we see. And how do we get in touch with you? What's your social media handle in case somebody wants to send you some Twitterage?
My Twitter account's kind of I don't even know what the thing is. My email, if anybody wants to get a hold of me, is sacchetti 1011 at gmail.com.
And I'm going to be sending out a tweet here just in a little bit with the picture with Al Sacchetti, and apparently he's not going to see it. So we will tag him in that. As for me, contact me, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, at everydaymed on Twitter. Also, make sure that you are subscribed to the podcast via SoundCloud or iTunes to make sure you're catching all of the releases. Right now, we're in this really big time of year where we're releasing the podcast from the SMAC conference as well as ACEP 17. So incredible information from around the United States and beyond and throughout the world. And I appreciate you tuning in. And until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ACEP Frontline.